Welcome to The Scrub Life, a podcast for and about the incredible profession of surgical technology. I'm Chris Blevins, and our mission at The Scrub Life is to educate the public about surgical technology. Each episode dives into the wonderful world of surgery, where we inform and hopefully entertain our listeners while interviewing amazing individuals within the field and presenting the hot topics everyone wants to know more about. We've now partnered with the Association of Surgical Technologists to help us expand our conversations, bolster our engagement, and bring further awareness to the surgical technology profession. CSTs are an integral part of the sterile team that cares for patients in the operating room. Learn more about this exciting field, the immense effort that goes into educating future CSTs, and how you too can become a ninja of the OR. Now, without further ado, here's the latest episode of the Scrub Life Podcast. Today's episode features surgical technology students. As some of you may know, the Scrub Life podcast began as a group senior project for my surgical technology program students back in 2018. Of course, the podcast has grown and evolved. For that, I could not be more grateful. But I always want to go back to our origin, and that is the importance of our students. So I've spoken across the country, sharing this peer-reviewed assignment with educators all over, and I am so happy that April Kessler, the program director at Northwestern Michigan College's Surgical Technology Program, definitely took me up on the offer. Today we are featuring Courtney Myers and Natalie Baylow and their episode on serial killer surgeons. These girls did such an amazing job, and they have a lot to say. I was able to interview them about doing the project, about what it was like being a student, clinicals, and of course, their very bright future ahead. So without any further pause, let's get started and listen to Courtney and Natalie, my interview, and then of course, we're gonna hop right into their episode recording. They did a fantastic job. All right, I have with me Courtney and Natalie, and we are going to talk about this upcoming episode because these two ladies are the students that recorded the second part of today's episode that you're going to hear on serial killer surgeons. But I really wanted to get your take on how you guys thought the assignment went and how school's going, and just definitely the student's perspective. So Courtney, Natalie, thank you for agreeing to talk to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Well, let's start with just your journey as a student. So where do you guys go to surgical tech school?
We go to Northwestern Michigan College currently.
Awesome. And you're both seniors and you're graduating at the end of the semester, right?
Yes.
Yeah. How does it feel? I feel like, I don't know, we'll start with you, Natalie, so that we go one at a time. But first of all, can you even believe that you're a senior? I mean, has time flown or do you feel like you've been in school forever?
Yes and no. Because I did college in high school, and so I had like all my prereqs done and ready for this by the time I was done with high school.
Yeah.
And so it feels like it hasn't really been that long in terms of like I was in high school and now I'm in college, but it's also been like, oh my god, thank god I'm finally done.
You can see the light at the end of the tunnel. So what made you choose surgical technology?
I knew I wanted to do something medical. Both my parents are in the medical field, and so that's kind of what I grew up with. And I was originally leaning more towards nursing, But just in general, I'm not like a very mushy gushy person. And so I was kind of worried about having to like deal with patients face to face and like the high emotions that come with the medical field and that kind of stuff in terms of patient interactions and dealing with their families possibly and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted something a little more behind the scenes. And I've always been okay with kind of blood and guts and stuff. So it was kind of that in between of something medical, something that I'm interested in, but without having to deal with the public.
Without having to talk to people, right?
Yes, exactly. Like I'm good with my team members, but like other random people, yeah, I'm good without that.
Good for you. Yeah. Well, Courtney, let's talk to you for a minute. So how's it been being a student and what made you choose surgical technology?
Personally, I also started college and high school like Natalie did. And I feel as if it has flown by, honestly. You know, we're still both very young and we're about to be out, you know, helping patients in the operating room.
It's a bit surreal.
Right.
Yeah. What made you choose surgical technology as your field of choice?
So I actually had to have surgery for a condition I had a few years back. And I just remember how I felt after it, how happy I felt, which it was basically fixing my hip. And in a way, I want to help patients feel that way.
Yeah.
I want to know that we're helping. And I like being able to see exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's really admirable. And it's, I don't know, having hip surgery, did it make you like want to choose ortho? Do you have like a favorite specialty?
Surprisingly enough, I don't favor ortho as much as I thought I would.
Yeah.
I still think it's cool, but my personal favorite is definitely neuro.
Yeah, most people, I think neuro is one of those specialties in surgery that people really love, or they're like, no, thank you. Do you like spine neuro or brain?
I was very fascinated by brain.
Yeah.
I got to do my first cranny not too long ago, and that was really cool to see.
It is neat. Yeah. You know, back in the day when I went to school, which we're not going to age me, but it was a long time ago, the idea that you as a student could even be in the same room as a cranny or an open heart or, you know, all of these big procedures was, it was just unheard of. And now it's like a craniotomy is one of those things that you guys are going to be expected to be able to do right after graduation. And I don't know, a little mind blowing. Natalie, what about you? Do you have a favorite specialty?
I am kind of the opposite of Courtney. I really like ortho. And I think it's interesting, Courtney, that you brought up like your hip surgery in terms of wanting to go into the field. Part of my going into the field was my mom had surgery. She had several, I believe four total surgeries on the same knee for the same original issue. She had to go through two different surgeons before she could finally get like the right procedure. And I like still wear one of her implants on a necklace because it's
cool.
Like that constant reminder of what I wanted to know, like what went wrong. Cause I was like very protective of my mom. Like, why wasn't this fixed in the first place?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to know, cause Courtney was like, I had a great experience and it was great. And I want to help people do that. Mine is kind of like something went wrong and I want to know why and like what could have been done to fix that. So like, if I can be that fixing for someone else, like that would be really neat. And so I keep her knee screw on a necklace with me. So it's like,
I want a picture of that necklace up close. That's so cool. I think it's really interesting that you both have had experiences in the realm of surgery and that it was, you know, so great and one of you not so great. I think it just speaks to what we do for a living, that you can have a really great day or you can have a really bad day. And either one of those decisions will affect somebody for the rest of their lives. How do you guys handle that pressure? I think, you know, it's one thing to know your instruments and know sterile technique, but especially since you were both young, what did you do to learn how to handle the pressure and the importance of the job? Because you guys now have been in it. You know the significance of what it is that you do. What's your coping mechanism? Video games. Courtney, she was like,
possibly.
You have to be able to blow off steam, but I don't know. How did you handle the pressure of just being at clinical and having patients, like real life patients in front of you?
I think going into clinical is definitely stressful because we were like, oh my God, this is like the real thing. But at least in my experience, it turned out to be like totally not as stressful as I thought it would be. And it is surgery in the operating room is a very serious environment. Like, you have to take what you're doing seriously. But it was kind of a shock to me, like, going into it, that you're in the room and you're scrubbed and everything, and your surgeon and the PA and the nurse and anesthesia, and you are like, you're all just talking and kind of joking around, and you're obviously paying attention to what you're doing and taking what you're doing very seriously. But the environment itself, it isn't as like cold and dry as I thought it was going to be, and like as like strictly serious as I thought it was going to be. So that was, it helped kind of take the pressure off of, oh, okay, this isn't like so intense as I imagined. Yeah. And then just kind of leaving it at work. Like, I'll come home, and like Courtney said, we're very young, so I still live with my parents. And so I'll come home and I'll tell my parents, like, oh my God, I did this today, it was so cool, or oh my God, everything was terrible today and this is why. But like, as soon as you get it out, like, it's fine. Mm-hmm. And I kind of try and leave all that kind of stress and stuff at work, so I don't bring it home into like my cozy space.
Yeah, your safe place. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, Courtney, what about you? How are you handling the pressure?
So currently I work in sterile processing. Mm-hmm. So I actually work directly with, you know, what I'm going to go to do.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that for about 2 years. And throughout it, I've kind of learned to remind myself, everyone starts somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I don't know. It's all just been a learning curve.
Yeah.
And I've been able to talk amongst my coworkers or people I'm working with in the OR. And honestly, getting to know people and talking about like some preceptors have told us mistakes they have made in the beginning, which has helped me realize, hey, we're all going to start somewhere. We'll get better with time. So,
and you're human.
Right.
Yeah. I think that as a teacher, I tell my students, we learn in the times that we screw up, right? So they're not mistakes, they're teachable moments. And nobody ever learns big life-changing things when everything's going perfectly. You know, we always learn when things are going the exact opposite. And the most important thing is recognizing it, that unrecognized contamination, like, that's what kills people. So knowing that when you make a mistake and then how to fix it, that's a lot. And I think a lot of the times knowing how to fix it just is going to come with experience, which you guys are on the front end of. So how many people are in your class?
5, including us.
5, including, so yeah. Have y'all gotten pretty close, do you feel like, throughout this journey?
I feel like, yeah. I mean, you kind of have to, because when you're in clinical and you're in lab, like, you have to work with these people. You don't really have a choice.
True.
And, you know, I mean, like, some of us are closer than others because you obviously have, like, your person, you know, like, each of us, I think, has a best friend in the class and stuff. But with that, a class that small, you kind of don't have a choice. Like, when it's, like, a group project, it's like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure I know who my partner is going to be.
Well, so let's talk about that group project, because April Kessler is your instructor, and she shared your episode with me. And I was so excited because that's how this whole podcast started. That's our origin story, if you will, it was a student assignment. And my students still do recordings and episodes every, you know, their senior year. And I used to speak all over the country to other surgical technology programs saying, hey, here's a peer-reviewed assignment, and my students actually really enjoy doing it, so use it. And I'm so excited that your program did that. So I want to get your first impressions, and it's okay, be honest. So when your instructor said, hey, this is your group project for your senior year, what was your initial kind of reaction?
Oh, great. Another group project. I hate group projects.
Yes. Courtney, what about you?
I am also typically not a fan of group projects because in my experience, I feel like there's been someone who's been pulling more of the weight, you know, and working together, or like trying to find schedules that work with other people. That's pretty difficult.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us in surgery, and so our type A personalities, we like to be in control, and I want to have complete control over my grade. So I don't want to have to rely on somebody else, right? Does that feel familiar?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, one of the things that I like about this assignment is it really forces you to be accountable and say what your part is the whole way. So when you guys were, did you choose each other or were you assigned to work together?
It was a random drawing. Our teacher like wrote our names or picked a number or whatever. And then if you got picked together, you got picked together. So it was, awesome. Because it was five of us, it was two and three.
Two and three. Perfect. So what was that first meeting like? How did you guys choose your topic?
So right off the bat, both of us knew that we loved true crime.
Yes.
So I was kind of excited that I actually ended up with Natalie because I knew we had that in common. Right. So it was actually pretty easy to choose a topic.
Very cool. Serial killer surgeons, what was researching that like? How did you begin?
I literally just like typed into Google like killer surgeons or like serial killer surgeons or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And an article popped up that I don't quite remember like who wrote it or like what the site was, but it was like top 20 killer doctors or something. And I was like, okay, that's not a great title to see. Like if you were just browsing the internet and you're like killer doctors, that's kind of a, that's not what they're supposed to do. But it like listed a bunch of different doctors and stuff throughout history that had not the greatest morals. And so I shared it with Courtney and I was like, hey, like these are the ones like I'm interested in, like 1, 3, 5, 10, and 9 or whatever. Like these are the ones that look interesting. And we tried to lean more towards ones that were more surgically focused versus like general, like family doctors, or whatever, because we were trying to keep it more of like surgical technology, surgical operating room themes. And then we each picked a couple and researched it and went from there.
That's really neat. I was shocked. I think when I've done some research in the past, that you have a top 20. Like, why are there so many? What is wrong with people? That would have freaked me out big time. There are so many to choose from. That's a little scary, especially when you know what they do for a living. You've seen what has to happen in the operating room. I don't know. What was the craziest story that you guys read?
I don't remember one in particular, but I know between the two of us, we each had a person that had Nazi connections. And I mean, we all kind of know how that went. And
so we know the history there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't like that surprising that they, have terrible morals, but it wasn't, you know, the greatest thing to have to like really research it and learn about the actual things that they did. So that wasn't great.
Wasn't the best thing to learn. Yeah. I don't know. Courtney, what do you remember about researching? What stood out for you?
I think one of the worst things, which obviously relating to today's like events, is about one of the people we researched that wanted to initially help women in their pregnancy and kind of turn their back on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that people may find interesting or.
Yeah, it's definitely creepy. Definitely creepy. Mm. So once you decided what you're going to do and you've researched it and you guys have come up with a plan, did you guys write an outline for how the episode would go? What did you decide to do for the actual flow of the information you were going to give?
I did my research. I read articles and listened to podcasts and stuff. And I like took down notes as I went. And then I kind of typed it up into a script. And just read off of that, which is why doing this kind of format is a little tricky because I'm just having like something to read off of. Exactly. To come up with stuff off the top of my head is making me a little nervous, but I typed it all up. I had it in like little sections so that we could record. Like I didn't have to try and record all of this information all at once. I could just do like each little section in case I messed up. We didn't have to completely start over.
Yeah. That's fun. What do you think worked best for you, Courtney, when you guys were doing this?
I actually just went with bullet points. Mm-hmm. And I did, going off of Natalie, I did mess up quite a bit and we did have to re-record, but we had time and we had fun. But I like doing the outline more than just reading off of a script. It feels more flowy, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how did you decide to record it? Were you guys together in the same room? Did you do it through Zoom? You know, there are so many options nowadays, for sure.
I went over to Courtney's apartment because she does do like gaming and stuff online. So she's got like the mic and everything. And we were like, perfect, we'll use that. And it was a little tricky to try and schedule because we were on opposite clinical schedules. So I was the first half of the week and she was the back half of the week. And then we both worked opposite days on the weekends. And so trying to figure out, like, we had completely opposite schedules. And so trying to find a day and time that worked for both of us was a little tricky, but we got it figured out. And it was nice because it was, we were the group of two versus the group of three. So it was only two schedules that we had to coordinate versus three of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love your setup. So I wish our listeners could see what you have. You've got like the badass gaming chair. You both have really awesome headphones. And Courtney over here has her microphone that looks way more professional than mine does down here. So I have to say, I'm a little jealous of your setup, but it looks really cool.
Oh, thank you.
It definitely helped you because when I listened to your podcast episode, it is very clear. I'm so impressed with the job that you guys did and how it goes. I can't wait for everybody to hear it as well. But in kind of wrapping up your experience with the podcast, you know, part of the assignment is a reflection. After you did it, what do you think, you know, what do you think you did well? What do you think you could have worked on? You know, your kind of your last thoughts. And so that's what I want to get from you guys. What did the assignment ultimately teach you? And what were your takeaways?
I think as much as I resented the idea of doing the group project in the first place, Courtney and I got along really, really well. We met in high school. So we already kind of knew each other even before going into this program.
Small world.
Yeah, right. So we actually worked really well together and we had to type up like a reflection and turn it in. And I wrote in there, I was like, this is probably one of the best group projects that I've ever done because both of us, like you said, are like that type A personality of like, I am going to put in the effort because I want a good grade and I want to get this done. And, you know, so I think we worked really well in that aspect of we both put in the appropriate amount of effort and it wasn't one person doing all the work because with the project like this, it can't be. But yeah, I think it was probably the best that it could have been.
That's awesome. Courtney, what about you?
I agree. I think this is one of the best projects I've had to do because we did work so well together. It was nice being able to like pick out our people and it was very simple to just, I do research on my person and talk about my person and you do the same.
Yeah. Well, I have to commend both of you on a job well done. And I hope that your positive experience with that helps, you know, the next person maybe not be so anxious about this assignment. And I can't wait for the thousands of listeners that we have to be able to hear it. So I'm super stoked about that. As we kind of end this interview, I think there are just a few questions I have, not about the podcast, but I have students on here. So I definitely want to pick your brain. But is there one thing you wish you had known about either our profession or the program before you became a student? Is there ever like, I wish somebody had told me this? How would you finish that sentence?
I wish someone told me that surgeons aren't as scary as you think they are.
I agree, right? Nobody's throwing things and yelling at you all day, every day. Natalie, what about you? Wish somebody had told me what?
Kind of similar, but also just like calm down, you know, like I think, at least for me, I got it like so worked up in my mind of like, oh my God, like this is so like such a serious thing. I just turned 20 a couple days ago. So I'm like 19 years old and working with these surgeons and like medical professionals and stuff, and they're going to trust me. Oh, like, oh my God. But like Courtney said, they're really not that scary and they're just people.
Yeah.
And you smile and nod and you give them what they ask for and everything's great. So just like, great. Chill out, man, calm down.
I love that. I think a friend of mine says, you know, they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like you and me. And I was like, what a great way to think about it. Cause they really do. Okay. Next question. What do you think is the best attribute of your favorite preceptor? Like not the one that you like the most, but the one who helped you grow. What is that one characteristic that you think a preceptor should have?
The ability to teach. which sounds kind of stupid because you're like, if they're a preceptor, that's the point. But I really appreciated when preceptors weren't just like, okay, they're going to want this, this, and this, which is nice because I need to know what the surgeon is going to need, but to explain why it is that they need that. And I really like those surgeons too that are excited to have a student in the room because they're excited to teach the student what's going on. And it's easier then to anticipate what the surgeon is going to want in the future if someone is telling you that's why you're giving them that instrument. So yeah. The preceptors and also the surgeons that were actually like, okay, give them this because of this. Mm-hmm. I found that really helpful. And so the ability to, I guess, explain what's going on and then why is, I think, the most beneficial.
That's awesome. Courtney, what about you?
I liked the preceptors that were able to push me out of my boundaries mm-hmm. and kind of learn like what the surgeons did want or what they favored, mm-hmm. you know, kind of let me stand up there and do my thing, you know, learn what worked well for me, what didn't work well, you know, such as like even handing instruments off a specific way. Like,
right. I think that's great. Okay. So now we're going to flip it. What do you think the best attribute of a really successful surgical technology student is?
Probably the ability to, at least what I found most successful, is like get along with people. Because if you can't get along with your preceptor, you're not going to be able to learn anything because you're just going to be struggling the whole time with each other. And if you can't communicate with your nurse, then you're not going to be able to get more supplies that you need. And the more that you kind of work with people, like not just on your team or in the OR that day, but like all of the other techs and all the other nurses, and the more that you can kind of like get to know them, it's going to make your life easier because they're more willing to help you. They're more willing to teach you. They're more willing to kind of help you grow as a student. And so obviously like learning the instruments and learning the procedure and like retaining that information is obviously very helpful. You kind of need to know that for your career. But I think making connections with your team members is also really important because those are the people that you are relying on to help you, to help the patient.
I love that. All right, Courtney, your turn.
Hard to top, but sort of going off of what she said, I think learning how to adapt. Right. To different situations. You will have different preceptors that will show you, you know, their ways, and you need to know maybe how they like to do their setup or, you know, why they do specific things a certain way.
Yeah.
So learning how to adapt to your environment when something goes wrong. You know, like I've had an experience in the OR already where something went wrong and I've had to adapt quickly.
Mm-hmm. And you're better for it, right?
It's helped. I've been able to kind of straighten my brain out. Like after that experience, I was like, wow, that was a lot. But I understand like, you know, what comes first in the event of, you know.
Yeah. When things hit the fan, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool when you come out the other side of it and you're like, okay, that was awful, but I made it through. And there, you got to feel good about coming out the other end and realizing that it may not have been perfect, but you're capable and you did it. And I hope you got a huge sense of pride off of that. Yeah. Oh, she's got a big smile at least. So ultimately, know the why, be uncomfortable, and don't be a jerk. The keys to a successful surgical technology program. Well, girls, thank you for taking time out of your busy lives to be able to talk to me and share your experience with creating this episode. I also just want to congratulate you on graduating. The future is so bright. And what are your plans? Like, you're about to graduate in it's a couple of weeks, isn't it? Yeah. So what comes next after you are done with school and your CST? What's on your docket then?
I am already working at the hospital that we did our clinicals at. Mm-hmm. They started kind of like an internship program for us to start working as techs before we're graduated. So I plan on hanging out there for a couple of years. I eventually want to travel. Mm-hmm. My family doesn't really travel a lot, so I kind of want to see the world and really see what's out there and help as many people as I can along the way.
I love that. Courtney, what about you?
So I plan on still going to school, actually. So I'm nowhere near done. I would like to go for my master's.
You're a glutton for punishment. That's what that is.
I suppose so. So I do plan to work, you know, as a CST until I am done with school and possibly become like an actual like surgical assistant, like possibly a PA.
I think that's really great that, you know, becoming a surgical technologist opens so many doors and pathways for you guys. And so I'm excited about it. Well, Natalie Balow and Courtney Myers, thank you. I really have enjoyed it. I hope you did too. And we can't wait for everybody to listen to your podcast episode because that's coming up next. So thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Courtney Myers.
And I'm Natalie Balow.
And we are current CST students at Northwestern Michigan College.
We're here today to discuss some surgical serial killers that we looked into, and not only compare them, but also see what could have been done to keep them from committing the atrocities that they did.
The two that I will be discussing today are Dr. Carl Klauberg and Dr. Michael Swango.
And I'm here to discuss Dr. Walter Freeman and Dr. Josef Mengele. Many know of the Auschwitz concentration camps and the horrors that occurred within, but how many know that the majority of decisions that led to the fate of those prisoners came down to one man? Dr. Josef Mengele, also known as the Auschwitz Angel of Death, was the deciding factor between life and death for thousands of Jewish prisoners. In 1935, Josef graduated with highest honors as a certified physician with a PhD in anthropology from the University of Munich. At 25, he worked as an assistant to racial scientist Otmar von Verschuer at the University of Frankfurt. With help from Nazi funding, Verschuer created the Institute for Heredity, Biology, and Racial Purity, which furthered the eugenics movement and helped the Nazis implement the Nuremberg Laws. These laws restricted the rights and citizenship of Jewish people, and Mengele and his colleagues were the deciding factor on whether people were Jewish or not. Verschuer also taught Josef that human experiments were totally acceptable, if not preferable, in order to advance science. Human experimentation still happens today, for example, vaccine and medication testing, but it's under much stricter guidelines and must pass FDA approval. One of Verschuer's biggest focuses was on the idea that twins were essential in learning more about genetics and were key to creating a quote-unquote master race. He saw twins as the perfect test subjects, one as a control and one for experiments. In 1939, Germany declared war on Poland, and in 1941, Josef was sent to Ukraine with the military. He decided to join the Viking division of the Schutzstaffel in order to become a field physician. Field physicians' main priority was to stabilize the patients long enough to transport them to proper care, which often means deciding who takes treatment priority. Unfortunately, due to his anti-Semitic views, Josef likely based his decisions on who best represented or who could best serve Germany. That same year, Josef was injured and removed from combat, and reconnected with his mentor, who was at that point the director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. Both Josef and his mentor felt that the best research for scientific advancement was going on at the concentration camps. Josef's mentor used his influence with the Nazi Party to get Josef assigned to Auschwitz as a doctor so that he could be in the thick of the human experiments that were going on there. In April of 1943, at the age of 32, Josef set off for Auschwitz, where he would evaluate prisoners as they exited the trains they were brought in on. He was once again making split-second life-or-death decisions, however this time it was in terms of who would live to be a prisoner and who would die in the gas chambers. He did, however, keep an eye out for very special people. Twins. While the actual records of Mengele's research were lost, information on the goings-on is still available via the stories of a few survivors. Like everyone else who was spared the gas chambers, Mengele's twins were showered and branded, though they did receive some special treatment that most prisoners did not. Their heads were not shaved, they weren't forced to wear the prison uniforms, and the guards didn't beat them. They were, however, made to fill out health history forms that would be sent back to Verschuer and likely served as a means of proving that Mengele's studies were for scientific purposes. Mengele's goal was to prove that everything about a person was due to their genetics, from their eye and hair color down to their behavioral traits. Mengele would personally interview his subjects while an assistant took their measurements. This gave him a chance to decide what testing he wanted to run on who, but it also allowed him to get to know the prisoners. He would sit and chat with the youngest prisoners, bring them sweets, and liked it when they called him Uncle Mengele. This rooted the patient's trust in Josef and made them more cooperative to his tests. The tests were run 6 days a week. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday were for measurements. Subjects were stripped down and every inch of them was measured. On Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, the twins were forced to give blood samples for hours on end while various chemicals were being injected into their arms. If their arms were too small, samples would come from the neck instead. Due to his Nazi allegiance, Mengele was obsessed with creating, quote-unquote, the perfect Aryan specimen. It is thought that he wanted to find the secret to changing a person's hair and eye color so he could send the results back to his mentor and colleagues. A pair of twin survivors recall being given eye drops that blinded them for several days. Others had chemicals injected directly into their eyeballs while Mengele waited on a color change that never came. Mengele truly didn't care about the well-being of his prisoners. One of the prisoners who reluctantly worked with him recalls how he killed several sets of twins all in one night merely to examine their corpses. 14 twins were injected with EpiPen to knock them out, followed by chloroform injected directly into their hearts to kill them. Mengele was once so convinced that a set of his twins had tuberculosis that he shot, killed, and dissected them, only to admit that they were in fact free of tuberculosis, just as the other doctors had claimed. In January of 1945, after packing most of his things, Mengele disappeared into the night, and whatever was left of his records were either destroyed or taken during the invasion of Auschwitz. Following his escape, only his survivors knew what he had done, and he was able to evade arrest for several years. He made it all the way to South America, where he remained in practice, though when a teenage patient of his died during an abortion, he moved on very quickly, rather than be discovered as a war criminal. Years later, in 1985, a group of surviving twins reunited to expose the truth of Josef Mengele. It had been 40 years since he'd left Auschwitz, and his victims were done waiting for justice that was never coming. After 3 days of testimony, it was demanded that apprehension efforts resume in order to capture the now 73-year-old doctor. The US, Israel, and Germany all began searching the globe until German forces exhumed a Brazilian grave that revealed Mengele's body. In 1979, Mengele had suffered a stroke while swimming and drowned at the age of 67. He was buried under the name Wolfgang Gerhardt and carried the secrets of his identity and his crimes to his grave.
In 1938, a few years prior to Josef Mengele's reign, a trained gynecologist was also a part of the Nazi party. His name was Karl Klauberg. Karl Klauberg was a trained gynecologist who at first wanted to research ways to help infertile women conceive children. After joining the Nazi party, Karl asked Heinrich Himmler, who was a leading member of the Nazi party, if he could be allowed to conduct experiments on women to figure out a quick sterilization procedure, one that could be performed on large amounts of people. When Karl would begin his experiments, his first step would be to check and make sure the women's fallopian tubes were open. Then he would inject a chemical that would cause acute inflammation, which would eventually cause the fallopian tubes to grow together before they were eventually obstructed. He typically performed these on mostly Jewish women. After the procedure was completed, x-rays would be done to check the results. Most experienced severe pain and even death. Some patients would even be killed just so an autopsy could be performed, just as Josef Mengele did with his twins years later. After leaving Auschwitz, Karl went back to Ravensbrück concentration camp, where he was later arrested by the Soviets and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Because of the German-Soviet repatriation agreement, which meant that prisoners of war were returned to their country of origin, Klauberg was released and then arrested by the Germans. He later died in 1957 before he could even stand trial.
I do think it's interesting that we both had some terrible doctors that were in the Nazi party, but I guess given the cruelty of the Nazi party, that makes sense. One of the things I'm wondering is if there was anyone to kind of keep them in check. Like, as surgical technologists, that's one of the things that we're taught to do is make sure the patient stays safe and keep the doctor kind of in check. So I wonder if there was anything that could have been done to stop our doctors from being just awful.
Well, I mean, they are in the Nazi party, so I think everyone around them kind of agrees with what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, both of the people we researched, both of them were just allowed to perform autopsies or actually kill people just for that pure...
Yeah, that is a good point. There was really... didn't really seem to be any overhead or peer-to-peer, like, hey, man, don't do that.
But they also seemed fine with the fact that both of them were performing sort of procedures on women and children.
Yeah, which is not great.
Michael Swango had an unusual interest in deaths, car wrecks, and the Holocaust. Growing up, he fell in love with chemistry. In high school, he actually wrote a thesis on a poison death, which is when he really became obsessed with poisons. He later entered med school, and at least 5 patients mysteriously died after seeing him.
he somehow still acquired neurosurgery residency, but evidently failed in the last 8 weeks from just failing to show up, not because of his malpractice. After failing his first neurosurgery residency, Swango somehow secured a new residency. Shortly after, guess what? Another series of unexplained deaths in the wing he was working in occurred. It was said that Michael Swango would often visit patients that weren't even his. After the unexplained deaths occurred, there was an investigation that rose, so Michael was eventually moved to a different wing. Shortly after, more people mysteriously felt ill. Fellow residents even began to feel ill after eating fried chicken that Swango actually brought in for them. Long story short, he was not welcome back for a second year of his residency. After yet again failing another residency, Swango packed up and moved to Ohio, where he picked up a job practicing medicine and ended up taking another job with an ambulance company, which did not check his background. He again fed food to his coworkers, who became ill, and they needed medical attention. Multiple of them decided to get tested, and several tested positive for poison. Whoa, shocker.
No way.
Wow. He would exhibit odd behavior, such as making inappropriate and strange comments about death, and being weirdly excited about mass killings and horrific incidents. When he arrived in South Dakota under his new and forged name, he once again acquired a residency position for internal medicine in 1992. At this point in time, things were actually going decently well for Swango, until someone, aka a friend of the dean at the university Swango was studying at in South Dakota, sent the dean a letter and informed them of Swango's background. That dean then sent a letter to every medical school in the U.S. to inform them about his past. Shortly after Swango's co-workers tested positive for poison, he was fired for unrelated circumstances. He was fired because he told a man in the midst of a heart attack to walk to his car and have his wife drive him. He was fired, and he had to change his name and forge his documents before moving to South Dakota. After being let go from, yet again, another residency position, Swango went underground. He ended up hiding and was resurfaced in 1994 under the name Jack Kirk, and he was working for a company in Atlanta that would give him access to all of the city's water supply. Once the FBI were able to locate Swango's location, he was fired. Only fired. He then ended up going to Zimbabwe and acted as a doctor. But then, what do you know? Patients began mysteriously dying. This is when police ended up going to his home and finding various drugs and poisons in his home, including recipes for various poisons. When Swango's home was searched, the police found multiple poisons, such as cyanide, which he was typically his drug of choice. After this, Swango attempted to flee again. In 1997, he was caught when he was en route to Saudi Arabia. What do you know? He actually pled guilty to fraud. But just before he was released, he was charged with murder. Finally! He knew that he would have to face the death penalty there, where he was in Zimbabwe, and he actually pled guilty for murder. Swango is currently serving 3 consecutive life sentences at ADX Florence, which is the only supermax federal prison in the U.S.
Our last doctor for the day is Dr. Walter Freeman. Back in the 1940s, psych diagnoses were nonspecific. The only knowledge of the brain at that time came from autopsies, and there was no concept of the link between brain chemistry and mental illness. A neurologist and medical professional by the name of Walter Freeman sought to genuinely help the mentally ill who flooded the asylum system around this time, and developed a new way to treat mental illness. He called it a lobotomy. Unfortunately, as he practiced, Freeman grew distracted by fame and his insistence that he was right. Though he never intended to kill his patients, in the over 30 years that he practiced, over 400 people lost their lives to his treatment. That would be 15% of his patient base.
Dr. Freeman came from a long line of doctors. He graduated from Yale in 1916 and attended medical school at the University of Pennsylvania. He wanted to be an adored neurologist without having to go through the rigor of becoming a neurosurgeon. After he graduated his residency, he got the position of lab director at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. in 1944. He was excited to discover that he was the youngest lab director to run one of the busiest mental hospitals in the country, with nearly 5,000 patients. While his enthusiasm to help those under his care was admirable, he also saw the patients as research opportunities. Around this time, there were no imaging studies available in order to understand the brain from the inside. Doctors didn't know how to cure mental illness at this time. They only knew how to treat the results of the symptoms. Freeman was convinced that in order to fix mental illness, you had to fix the brain itself. When his initial research yielded little to no results, he turned from treating living patients to opening up the skulls of dead ones. This also yielded unsuccessful results because mental illness does not express itself as a physical abnormality in the brain. It was then that Freeman began to suspect that mental illness may stem from issues within the neural network of the brain, and from there he began to focus his research on the frontal lobes. In 1936, Freeman stumbled upon an article discussing the effectiveness of altering the synapses in the frontal lobe with relative success, a procedure the developer called a leucotomy. Freeman wanted to replicate these results, but he wanted to do it now and with his own spin. The difference between the leucotomy and what Freeman wanted to do was that rather than remove cores of the frontal lobe as the leucotomy does, Freeman wanted to completely sever the nerve strands between the thalamus and the frontal lobe, thus he called it a lobotomy. Since the procedure could be performed with the patient knocked out, Freeman decided why not try it with them awake. As Watts would make the cuts, Freeman would ask the patient questions and monitor their response. He wanted to learn the results of different depths of cuts. However, because the cuts were permanent, only so much could be observed per patient. This didn't bother Dr. Freeman too much, as he had a wealth of test subjects available to him. In the late 1930s/early 1940s, informed consent wasn't really a concept yet, so it's doubtful that any of his patients truly knew what was being done to them. By the end of 1941, Freeman and Watts had standardized the lobotomy, making it faster and more effective than ever. Freeman was a showman and invited reporters to watch his successful surgeries so that they could be reported in the evening papers. However, not all of his lobotomies were successful. In November of 1941, 23-year-old Rosemary Kennedy, the youngest sister of President John F. Kennedy, was brought to Freeman because she showed wild behavior and the family feared she would cause a pregnancy scandal. She suffered from possible seizures and mood swings, and Freeman diagnosed her with agitated depression. Though Freeman's diagnosis was likely correct, her lobotomy was anything but. She was left with the mental capacity of a toddler and was unable to speak coherently. The cut that was made in her brain was likely too deep, resulting in negative effects in the limbic system, which is responsible for emotional regulation. Rosemary Kennedy was institutionalized for the rest of her life. She never recovered her faculties and needed a caregiver 24/7. Dr. Freeman refused to ever take responsibility for any negative side effects his patients experienced, choosing to believe that any postoperative issues were the patient's fault and nothing to do with his procedure. By 1942, he had performed nearly 200 lobotomies with a whopping 63% success rate.
Wow.
At this time, he was chairman of the neurology department at George Washington University, and with his lobotomy technique, he was a hero to the public. Doctors, however, were not so pleased with him. They were upset with the fact that he was using an untested procedure on uninformed patients. Freeman ignored their concerns and chose to instead focus on public opinion. It was around this time that Freeman grew upset that he developed this revolutionary procedure, but was unable to perform it himself, and instead began looking for a non-surgical way to achieve his lobotomy. Freeman once again began researching, and this time found that the skull is especially thin behind the eyeball, and that by taking a thin, sharp metal rod and inserting it above and behind the eye, the skull could be fractured and access to the frontal lobe could be achieved. He also knew that he could ditch general anesthesia for electroshock, and his patients would be sufficiently knocked out. Rather than use an actual surgical instrument, Freeman somehow decided that small ice picks would be the best tool for what he was looking to achieve. All he needed was two slender picks, a small hammer, and his portable electroshock machine. One day, when Dr. Watts walked into the office he shared with Dr. Freeman and observed him performing his idea, he was disgusted by what he saw. Dr. Freeman had the patient in their outpatient clinic with an ice pick sticking out of each eye socket and absolutely no regard for sterility. Dr. Watts walked out and never worked with Dr. Freeman again. Dr. Freeman was unbothered by the loss of his colleague and began touring the country with his newly redesigned lobotomy technique. He was able to perform the transorbital lobotomy in less than 10 minutes and would again turn them into performances for the hospital staff where he was visiting. While in West Virginia, he performed 228 lobotomies over a span of 12 days, totaling nearly 20 lobotomies a day. He once again invited reporters to observe this miraculous technique of his and boasted that patients who had been in the asylums for weeks, months, and even years would be able to go home within hours. He was finally getting the attention that he desired and didn't care what other doctors had to say, convinced he knew best. When Freeman had a patient return to him with complications from her original prefrontal lobotomy, he cared more about completing the severing of the frontal lobe tissue that they had missed the first time, rather than helping her with the newly accumulating fluid in her brain. She died 3 weeks later from hydrocephalus. Once again, Freeman refused to take any blame for his lobotomies causing any of her issues. He believed that a longer life with mental illness was worse than risking a life for a cure. In the early to mid-1950s, chlorpromazine, also known as Thorazine, was introduced as an antipsychotic drug. Now considered one of the greatest milestones in the history of psychology and pharmacology, chlorpromazine blocks the dopamine receptors in the brain, thus preventing the excess dopamine production responsible for psychosis and mood disorders. Due to this revolutionary little pill, people began to turn their backs on the more aggressive treatment that was Dr. Freeman's lobotomy. Unfortunately, Freeman could no longer take being top dog and began to turn his attention onto children. When a patient's stepmom came to Freeman complaining of her stepson's behavior, Freeman decided that the young boy's symptoms weren't the normal behaviors of a 12-year-old boy, but instead evidence of mental illness, and decided the child needed a lobotomy. The boy spent the rest of his life feeling that something was taken from him, and he later found out that his stepmom had gone to several doctors who said that he was a normal 12-year-old boy before Freeman agreed to lobotomize him anyway. Due to the increase in popularity of drug therapy, Dr. Freeman's treatment became less and less popular, and people were beginning to discover how ineffective and damaging it truly was. A lobotomy patient's standard day basically consisted of not dying. They could manage very simple menial tasks, and that was about it. Their personalities had been completely wiped, and they were very subdued, almost robotic in their demeanors. In 1967, Freeman's last and final patient suffered massive hemorrhaging after Freeman accidentally nicked a blood vessel in her brain. This nick immediately depleted the oxygen levels in your brain, and she died. Had the surgery been done by a qualified surgeon, they would have been prepared and educated on what to do in case of such an event, and the patient would have been more likely to survive. The medical community did not take kindly to this, and Dr. Freeman's practice was permanently closed. In early 1968, desperate to prove that he was still right and a lobotomy was still the most effective way to treat mental illness, Dr. Freeman set out to find his previous patients in order to prove himself a success. However, all that he found were his patients going through the motions of a life without meaning or purpose, and by 1970, lobotomies had been deemed illegal in several countries around the world. On May 31, 1972, Dr. Freeman died after fatal complications from a cancer operation. Although his lobotomy was wrong, it was a step in the right direction in order to lead the conversation towards alternative treatments and to look further into the relationship between brain chemistry and mental health.
The one thing I noticed, like, between the two of our guys is, yes, there wasn't really anyone telling either of our people, hey, maybe this isn't a good idea, but, like, no one really, I guess, told on your guy, tattletailed.
No, there was his partner who was like, I'm out.
But that was it.
That was
it. He was just like, I'm done.
At least with your guy, someone went to the dean and was like, hey, do you actually know who this guy is?
Yeah, he's doing bad things.
And then the dean was like, hey, everyone, don't associate with this guy.
Right.
Yeah, no, my guy was very, like, in his head and, like, convinced that he was right, so.
Nowadays, there are obviously, like, more specific laws made to protect patients against malpractice, but I guess, for example, mine was set in the 90s, which actually wasn't that long ago, but still, just showing how far we've come from, you know, 30 years ago to now.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting, too, like, mine was back in the 1940s, and like I mentioned earlier, there was no such thing as informed consent at that point, which is one of the things the doctors were upset about. So I guess there kind of was someone telling him no. The doctors, like, when he would go to medical conferences, there was people who were like, hey, man, you maybe shouldn't be doing this random procedure that you came up with on people who don't know what you're doing to them. But he was like, eh, they're mentally ill. I'm helping them.
And they were like,
are you helping them by driving a stake through their skull? Are you helping them? I don't think you are.
I guess so.
I don't know. I think it's interesting. And I think to tie it all back into surgical technology as a whole, I think it's pretty important that as surgical technologists that we try and be that voice for the patient. And
notice, you know, that maybe surgeons might not be taking the best care.
Right, and it's hard to stand up to a surgeon and be like, hey, don't do that, but it's something that needs to be done for the sake of the patient.
For example, the guy that I just spoke about, Michael Swango, he purposely injected poisons into a woman's uterus. Mm-hmm. And the nurses were supposedly too scared to speak up.
Yeah, that's the issue, which is understandable. Like, this right. guy sounds awful, but it's something you gotta do. It's, like, that medical ethics and, like, that surgical conscience and stuff. You have to, like, keep an eye on that. And even though it's hard to do, even if you don't, like, go directly to the surgeon, like, going to at least someone who can tell them, dude, stop. Yeah.
Research for this podcast has been provided by Murderpedia.org for Dr. Joseph Michael Swango and Physicians Weekly, .14, Most Evil Doctors of the Last Two Centuries for Carl Klauberg.
Research for Dr. Josef Mengele and Dr. Walter Freeman is provided by Medical Murders Podcast.
If you would like more information on how to utilize this capstone project in your own surgical technology program, you can find the assignment instructions, grading rubric, along with a few examples of student work at our webpage. Go to thescrublifepodcast.com. Also, if you would love to be a part of this podcast or have any ideas for future episodes, I would love to hear from you. You can reach me at Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at thescrublifepodcast.com. And lastly, to all of you students, this episode is celebrating you. We're almost to the end of your semester. For many of you, this means that you're graduating. So a huge congratulations to you all. I am so honored to be able to call you colleagues. And for those of you who maybe aren't quite there yet, but you get to enjoy the holiday break, really do take this opportunity to get some rest, recharge and refresh, and get back at it, because you're almost there and it is so incredibly worth it. So students, here's to you, Northwestern Michigan College students, congratulations. And I can't wait to meet all of you at our upcoming events and to hear from you in regards to future podcasts.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Scrub Life podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the Scrub Life podcast. Show notes for this episode, as well as past episodes, our contact information, and the virtual suggestion box can be found at our webpage, thescrublifepodcast.com. This has been Chris Blevins and Stephanie Austin with the Scrub Life Podcast. Until next time, be safe, support each other, and stay sterile.